Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. No terrorist attacks have occurred on American soil since 9/11. Does that mean that what we call the war on terror has made us more safe? This morning in this hour of the show, we will take up that question with David Cole. He's professor of law at Georgetown University. He is also the legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and co-author of a new book that says it all. At least the title will definitely tell you where he and his co-author, Jules Lobel from University of Pittsburgh, will tell you where they're coming from. The title is Less Safe, Less Free, and the subtitle, Why America is Losing the War on Terror. It's published by the New Press, in which they make the argument that not only has the response to 9/11 of the administration compromised some fundamental principles of law, they would in fact argue that it has actually made America less safe. We'll get more on that as we talk with David Cole in this hour of the show. And of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions and comments. We only ask people to try to keep those questions and comments brief so that we can get as many callers in as possible. But questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening on the Internet here in the United States, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Cole, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure.
Well, just to ask the most straightforward and basic question first, it is, I'm sure that there are people who will argue that the fact that there has not been a successful terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11 means that the policies of the administration have been successful, and in fact, we are more safe than we were before 9/11. I know that you would give a different answer.
Yes, I would. I don't want to suggest that there's nothing that has been done that has made us safer. I think there have been measures that have been effective at increasing our security. I mean, for one thing, we are we're paying much more attention to the threat of terrorism. We're devoting substantially more resources to it. Thousands of FBI agents, for example, instead of a handful. That all of that is likely to make us safer. We have better screening at airports. Not perfect, but perfection is not possible. I think that the initial attack on Al Qaeda's camps in Afghanistan, was successful in closing those camps, in closing their headquarters, in capturing or killing many of their members and leaders, capturing laptops that have then led us to other people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So I don't want to overstate it here, but I do think that the particular strategy that the Bush administration adopted, which was this, what John Ashcroft called the paradigm of prevention, has been a horrific failure in terms of identifying actual terrorists, disrupting actual terrorist plots, bringing terrorists to justice, and making us more secure. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by the preventive paradigm is this notion that it is now justified for the state to use the harshest coercive measures within its control against individuals or against countries based not on objective evidence established through fair procedures that someone has engaged in criminal activity or is engaged in criminal activity or is even conspiring to engage in criminal activity, but rather based on predictions, necessarily speculative, often mistaken, as we saw in Iraq, about what somebody or some country might do in the future. These predictions are often predicated on on stereotypes, on prejudice, and the like. And the administration has detained people based on such predictions. It has coercively interrogated, waterboarded, tortured people in the hope of obtaining information that might prevent some future atrocity. It has launched a catastrophic war in Iraq, also under this theory of the preventive war, the notion that we can attack another country that has not attacked us, that doesn't imminently threaten to attack us, on the theory that, well, they might do something in the distant future that we want to prevent by attacking them now. And I think those kinds of measures have had very little positive effect on our security and have had horrific effects in terms of our standing, in terms of our ability to work with the kinds of communities we need to work with if we're going to keep ourselves more secure over the long term.
Yeah. And I think just to toss out some numbers to in this effort to sort out the subjective from the objective in terms of terrorism and the effectiveness of the American policy in reducing terrorism, it is true that there has not been an attack on American soil, but if you ask this question, well, what do you see if you look at the number of terrorist attacks around the world? You see that, in fact, they are not decreasing in frequency. They are increasing, and if you set that against the number of people who have been convicted for being directly involved in a terrorist attack, it's at least in here in the United States, that number runs to one.
Right.
That the number of terrorist attacks has gone, you know, between, say, 2001 and 2005, went up very, very significantly. So
around the world.
Around the world, yeah. Yes. We should be clear on that point, that what we're talking about is terrorism around the
right.
world.
Right. And in fact, we recount a story in the book about how the State Department I think it was 2003, but I'm not 100% sure on the year, issued its annual report on international terrorist incidents and announced that the number of terrorist incidents had actually dropped. And Richard Armitage, who was the Deputy Secretary of State, said, "See, the global war on terror is working. We're making the world a safer place." Until about 2 months later, when Colin Powell had to come out, then the Secretary of State had to come out and admit that they had miscounted, and that when the accurate numbers were used, the number of terrorist incidents had actually increased. And in fact, every year since 9/11, the number and lethality of terrorist incidents around the world has increased markedly. Meanwhile, of course, over 3,000, we lost 3,000 people in World Trade Center, but we've lost more than that now in terms of U.S. soldiers in Iraq, fighting a war that we never needed to begin, and 10 to 20 times that number at least in terms of Iraqi civilians killed as a result of that war. And we're told by our security agencies that Al-Qaeda has fully reconstituted itself in the border regions of Pakistan. So while we closed down its training camps and its headquarters temporarily with our initial foray into Afghanistan by simultaneously sort of switching our focus to Iraq and alienating the rest of the world giving the best possible recruitment fodder to Al-Qaeda, we have gotten to a position where Al-Qaeda is as strong today as it was on 9/11, according to our own intelligence agencies. Mm. So how can you say we're winning if that's the case?
Let me pose a question like this, and again, it goes to this the question of what are the consequences of the approach the administration has taken, where they're saying we're going to look at people not because we know that they have done something, but because we think that they might. And if we say that we know that there are people who are being put in jail for long periods of time and without charge, or have been tortured anywhere, have been put on a plane and sent to someplace else where they're tortured by somebody else on our behalf, if there is increased surveillance and profiling of particular individuals, those things, for many Americans, they'd say, well, that does not touch me directly. What exactly, they might ask a question like this, well, what's that got to do with me? When you talk about attacks on civil rights that affect everyone, for people who don't feel that that has personally touched them, how do you answer a question like, well, what's that got to do with me?
Right. Well, I think there's a couple ways that it has to do with all of us. I mean, one is that the compromises that we have seen since 9/11 really compromise our character, the character of this nation. I mean, I think, you know, if you asked what does it mean to be an American, what does it mean to be a part of this country, I think it means not just rooting for the USA in the Olympics, but being committed to a certain set of principles like equality, liberty, fair trials, transparency. The government has to show us what it's doing so we can be sure it's following law, checks and balances, basic human rights. And what we have seen since 9/11 is, in the name of this preventive paradigm, an administration that has compromised all of these most fundamental principles, all of these commitments to equality, fairness, liberty, fair trials, and the like. And that's, you know, as John McCain said when he was spearheading the effort to overturn the administration's interpretation that it could subject foreigners to cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment because they were foreigners, he said, you know, it's not about who they are, it's about who we are. And so I think we all have a stake in this because it is ultimately about our character and about who we are. We also all have a stake in it because none of us wants to be the victim of another terrorist attack. And as we argue in the book, these measures have backfired. They've been incredibly ineffectual and counterproductive from a security standpoint alone. So even if you don't care about our character, you just care about the United States not being targeted for another terrorist attack, we are going about it in the wrong way. We're going about it in a way that is likely to increase our vulnerability to terrorist attacks over the long term because we have alienated so much of the world. And as I said before, we have given al-Qaeda the best recruitment propaganda it ever could have hoped for. I mean, you know, a country attacking a predominantly Muslim country that did not attack it, and securing its oil as soon as it got in there, that plays right into al-Qaeda's propaganda. A country that says we can waterboard you because you're not an American, we can lock you up for the rest of your life without a hearing because you're not an American, you're a Muslim, you're a foreign national, you're an Arab. That plays right into al-Qaeda's playbook. That's how they want us to respond, because when we respond that way, it drives people away from us and into al-Qaeda's camp. And that's we have to avoid that if we're going to be successful over the long term.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Again, let me just quickly introduce our guest, David Cole. He's professor of law at Georgetown University. He's legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. He's a constitutional law scholar. He is the co-author, along with Jules LaBelle from University of Pittsburgh. He's a law professor there. They're the co-authors of the recently published book, Less Safe, Less Free, Why America is Losing the War on Terror. It's published by The New Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone calling from Muhammad, not too far away from us, on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I would just say that they don't have any reason anymore to come over here and kill us, because all they have to do is walk out their front door and kill the best of our young men. Why would they spend money for plane fare over here if they can do it over there? And you don't make friends with a country by invading them and blowing their families up. It's just crazy what's going on. And I sometimes wonder if the neocons who are in control right now don't really want to bring about the Crusades again and perhaps even Armageddon. Otherwise, there's just doesn't seem to be an explanation for it. And instead of ranting on, I'll ring off. Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Gold, you can respond any way you like.
Yeah, well, the caller makes a good point. I mean, President Bush says, we're fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them here. That was his line, right? But, you know, what that means literally is sacrificing over 3,000 American soldiers' lives and ten to 20 times that many Iraqi civilians' lives. Is that really, you know, a morally legitimate trade-off, number one? Number two, what the evidence that we have is that the Iraq war has actually created more terrorists. It's not as if there were these terrorists out there and they would have come here, but instead they turned around and went to Iraq. There have been studies of the people who've been involved in suicide bombings and the like. Many of those people had never been involved in any kind of terrorist activity or a group or whatever prior to the Iraq War. And we then launched the Iraq War, and it becomes a rallying cry that inspires many people to take up the cause against us, travel to Iraq, and engage in this kind of activity for the first time ever. Porter Goss, who was at the time he testified in Congress, the head of the CIA, said, you know, he acknowledged we are training people over there. We closed the training camps in Afghanistan, but Iraq is an incredible training ground for terrorists. They're getting sharper and they're getting more sophisticated every day, and those who survive will go on and leave there and haunt us for years to come, just as Al-Qaeda itself and Osama bin Laden were involved in a internal crisis in Afghanistan, a conflict with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. We went in and we supported them, we trained them, and they turned around and, of course, became our attackers. But here we're training people not by providing them training, but providing them targets and motives and a rallying cry to join up against us. And, you know, in that regard, calling it a global war on terror is sort of the worst thing we could do, because it says to every potential terrorist, most of whom are, you know, concerned with domestic grievances, not international grievances, you know. We're saying to all of them, look, you can take an act against the United States by blowing up something in Pakistan or blowing up something in the West Bank or in Israel that all of these acts are united. We united them. I mean, the last thing we want to do is unite these very disparate groups that most of whom don't particularly have a focus on the United States by sort of creating this global war on terror, and yet that's what we've done.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have thought from 9/11 that this was a crime and not to be handled as a war, which is that whole terminology in this situation is to me absolutely ludicrous. I'll ring off, but would you talk about having approached this whole thing as a crime and all the international, you know, like Interpol and so forth go after this situation rather than having declared a war and all the ugliness that has come since then?
Certainly, In fact, one of the most common criticisms of the United States' approach in Europe is precisely our sort of turning this thing into a war. You know, the United Kingdom faced terrorism from the IRA for 30 years, and for 30 years the IRA wanted the United Kingdom to call it a war. And the UK said, no, we're not going to call it a war. You're criminals. You're not warriors. You're criminals. And many European countries have had to deal with long-standing terrorist threats from internal and external, and they have they have tended to treat it as a crime, not as a war, in part because what the terrorists want is renown and glory, and if you call it a war, you have essentially given them that renown and that glory, and that can then be a rallying cry and a recruitment tool for them. So and certainly terrorism is a crime. I mean, you know, when Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City federal building, we didn't declare war on them or on white isolationist groups in the United States. We prosecuted them as criminals, and one Timothy McVeigh was executed, and Terry Nichols is locked up for the rest of his life. When the blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, was found to be conspiring with others to blow up bridges and tunnels around Manhattan, we called it a crime, not a war, and we put him on trial and put him and his co-conspirators on trial. We convicted them, and they are spending the rest of their lives in prison, and where they can't threaten us, and where they can't, sort of rally up the troops in some kind of war cry. So there is an argument that the criminal response is a better response. Now, I will say though that I don't, and we don't in the book, rule out using the military to respond to terrorists in certain circumstances. And we don't take the position that the initial military incursion into Afghanistan was illegal under international law. We knew that this is where the group was, that it had attacked us, on several occasions in the past, that it had declared war on us, and we asked Afghanistan, the Taliban, the then governing force in Afghanistan, to turn over Al-Qaeda to us. They refused to do so, and we then went in with force and closed down the camps and the like. And that, I think, was that was a legitimate act of self-defense, legal under international law, recognized as such by the UN, by NATO, by the 120 countries that initially supported that. That effort around the world, and I think some good came from that in terms of for a while anyway, undermining Al-Qaeda's ability to conduct a follow-on attack. And I wouldn't want to rule out the possibility of using military responses in a targeted way in certain situations where there's a really grave attack like that which we suffered on 9/11. So I wouldn't be dogmatic and say you can only go respond through the criminal process. But I do think that there is an argument that the military process undermines your standing, that you should certainly try as much as you can to pursue terrorists through the criminal process, only use military as a last resort, and certainly not use it in this preventive way as we did in Iraq. Mm.
As I mentioned back near the beginning of the program, that since 9/11, only one person here in the United States has been convicted for being directly involved in an actual attempted act of terrorism, and that was Richard Reid.
Yeah, one Islamic terrorist. There have been a couple. There was an anti-abortion bomber who was convicted. But in terms of Islamic terrorism, the only person convicted since 9/11 is Richard Reid. The shoe bomber, and of course, he wasn't captured through any brilliant preventive paradigm initiative, but because an alert airline attendant saw this strange-looking guy trying to light his shoe.
Yeah. So this is the one person. Now, at the same time, the administration has detained a lot of people, has put people in jail. We've got people in Guantanamo, and in fact, the administration will point to as a success the fact that it has obtained convictions of individuals in terror-related, and that apparently is the catch. Terror-related cases for the people who actually have been convicted of something related to terrorism. What were they convicted of?
Right. Well, this is if you go on the government's website for how it's doing in the war on terror, which is lifeandliberty.gov, you'll see claims such as that we've indicted over 400 people in terror-related cases, and we've convicted or got guilty pleas in over 200 of those cases. That sounds like a lot of terrorists, but when you actually look at those cases, it turns out that they don't, for the most part, they're not cases in which a charge of terrorism has been leveled. They're totally routine cases that have just been put in a category by the Justice Department, which is called terror-related. Whether or not there's anything in the case that has anything violent at all. So the vast majority of these cases, when you look at them, are for things like credit card fraud, check writing fraud, filling out a federal form falsely, lying to an FBI agent, not contributing to your local public radio station as you should. You know, they're not for serious violent crimes, much less terrorism. And the Washington Post looked at all the convictions and found that only 39 of them had any terrorist charge in them whatsoever. And we then look at those 39 and find that almost all of them, you know, putting aside Richard Reed, almost all of them are under this statute called the Material Support to Terrorist Organization Statute, which is essentially a guilt by association statute. It allows the government to get a quote-unquote terrorist conviction without proving that an individual engaged in any terrorist activity, conspired to engage in any terrorist activity, aided or abetted any terrorist activity, or ever intended to further terrorism in any way, shape, or form. All they have to show is that an individual made some sort of donation of goods, of services, of money, volunteering his time, giving somebody a ride to an organization or an individual that has been put on a blacklist as a quote-unquote designated terrorist individual or group. And there need be no showing that the support actually furthered any kind of terrorism or was intended to further any kind of terrorist activity. So giving blankets to a hospital would qualify. Giving a meal to a hungry person would qualify if that person or that hospital happened to have been designated as on these various blacklists. So when you come down to it, you get one person, Richard Reed, who's actually convicted of an attempted terrorist attack, and virtually everybody else, it's a material support conviction. In some instances, it's a kind of conspiracy, a very, very broad conspiracy conviction, as they got with Jose Padilla, who was convicted under a conspiracy statute that allows the government to get a conviction without actually identifying any crime, any particular crime that he conspired to engage in. There's not a lot of there when you actually look at the convictions, and then if you look at the numbers of people preventively detained, the numbers are even worse.
We have other callers. Let us continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I really admire your work quite a bit, and the one thing I really admire is how you can be collegial with David Rifkin, who's one of the apologists for for this surreal reign of terror. I do want to tell people that I think there is a different narrative about Afghanistan, and I think that people should investigate that. One could actually say that tactically going all in with weaponry as a military thing and using the Northern Alliance and the existing warlord structure that we've done is terribly counterproductive too. So even on a tactical level, but I do think there is another narrative that the U.S. didn't want to, turn bin Laden over to a third party or a world court, which was one of the things that was sort of on offer. But I don't want to get bogged down in that, because I'd like to ask you about testimony under torture and sorting out the military courts and how they can use hearsay qualifications to not be cross-examined. Is that how that works? So that the brass. So there's a lot of stuff there. But one of the things that is so egregious is that Al Libby was tortured, and he's the one that they tied this training training, that Iraq was somehow training al-Qaeda with chemical weapons, and it was totally because he wanted the torture to stop. There's been a recent exposé that 30% of the footnotes in the 9/11 Commission report are implicated by the fact that the testimony came from torture. It's an astonishing story, it seems to me. And when you think that they're, you know, well, anyway, I think there's a lot of fodder there, if you would go on.
Yeah. Well, it's really, I mean, this is one of the, I think, most short-sighted decisions that the administration made, which was essentially to use interrogation tactics that would might gather some useful intelligence, but might, as in al-Libi's case, gather totally false and misleading information, which was turned out to be very costly for us, but that certainly is going to make it impossible to use that information to hold anyone accountable for what they've done. So, you know, when you waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he might tell you the truth. He might tell you lies. Who knows? You know, but he's going to say whatever he can to get the drowning to stop. But what you do know is that you're not going to be able to use that evidence to hold him responsible for his involvement in 9/11. You're also not going to be able to use that evidence to hold anybody else accountable for their involvement in any kind of terrorist activity, and that information is going to taint any efforts to hold other people accountable, because unless you can establish that all of your investigation was conducted without access to the any leads obtained through the waterboarding and the coercive interrogation and the torture, you're not going to be able to put that evidence in any fair proceeding. And so there's a real long-term cost, which is that you can't hold people responsible for really serious wrongdoing because you've essentially immunized them by the way in which you decide to interrogate them. And we made that decision that sort of early on, well, we want to get the intelligence, too bad if we can't hold them responsible. And now we're sort of stuck in this box where we don't know what to do. We can't really release somebody like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but how are you going to bring them to justice? This is yet another example of how this preventive paradigm, which in this context makes coercive interrogation something that ought to be unthinkable, into something that was very much thinkable and authorized by the Bush administration, we were paying the cost for that, both in terms of our inability to put people on trial who ought to be held accountable for their wrongs, and of course, maybe more profoundly, in terms of the kind of anti-American sentiment that that kind of treatment of people builds around the world. And, you know, every year since 9/11, not only have terrorist incidents around the world increased in number and lethality, but the percentage of people who are anti-American, who share significant anti-American resentment around the world, has increased. And when you ask them why, it is because of the sense that the United States isn't willing to play by the rules that it insists everybody else must play by, that it's hypocritical, that it doesn't care about other people, that it's willing to impose on other people's nationals treatment that it would never tolerate if imposed on our own citizens.
I'm going to jump in here. We have just about 15 minutes left. We have some other callers, and we've been talking for a while here, and I also want to introduce again the guest for anybody who might have joined us in the last 10 or minutes or so. David Cole, he's professor of law at Georgetown University. He is legal affairs correspondent for The Nation and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. He's a constitutional scholar, also has been involved in litigating civil liberties cases, particularly those that are terror-related. He is the co-author, along with Jules Lobel, who teaches law at University of Pittsburgh, of a recently published book. The title, Less Safe, Less Free, Why America is Losing the War on Terror, and it's published by the New Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana and on line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm going to ask a little bit of a provocative question.
Good.
It concerns the definition of terrorists. And what I'm trying to get around to is, are terrorists only those who attack us or our interests? Or do we ever use the word for what we do everywhere in the world, especially now? Who puts us on trial for what we do? And there certainly have been atrocious acts which we've committed, certainly in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. I just wanted to get your response to that.
Yeah, well, the traditional definition of terrorism is the use of violence directed at civilians for the purpose of for a political purpose, to intimidate a population or to affect policy, and many people, many scholars add in by a non-state actor, which gets us off the hook.
Yeah, too easy.
But that's too easy, it seems to me. I mean, you know, if you think about if you think about that definition, first of all, no reason why we call other states terrorists, and there's no reason why a state can't be just as morally culpable for engaging in violence targeted at civilians for a political purpose. But if you think if that's the core definition, well, probably the greatest terrorist act, certainly one of the greatest terrorist acts of all time, is the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, knowing that we would kill, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of civilians to affect a population in the hopes that it would press the Japanese to surrender, and so you know, terrorism is a very capacious word. I think it can be applied to states as well as to non-state actors. I think it's never acceptable, whether it's done by us or by Al Qaeda. In terms of who holds us accountable, you know, that's of course a big question. There are growing movements for something called universal jurisdiction, which holds that any state can hold people of other states responsible for certain core violations of human rights, like torture. And there have been efforts to in other countries to bring Pinochet to justice. There have been efforts to get Donald Rumsfeld indicted in France and in Germany. Thus far, those have not succeeded. But I think there's a serious possibility that over, you know, the next 10 to 20 years, that some high-level government officials will, in fact, be indicted in other countries for, in particular, for authorizing torture, you know, at Guantanamo, at CIA black sites, at Abu Ghraib, and the like.
Yeah, at the Nuremberg trials, of course, one of the greatest crimes against humanity was supposed to be a war of aggression.
Yeah.
And that seems to have gone by the boards. Yeah. We have essentially ignored that.
Yeah.
We have certainly been the aggressors. In any case, thank you very much for your...
Thank you.
We'll continue. We'll take another caller here. This is someone listening in Champaign in line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to be provocative, but in the other direction. From where you've been going with the paradigm of criminal prosecution, especially since you brought up the whole issue of various other countries. I mean, if we look at, let us say, the situation in England, in Great Britain, the situation in Spain, the situation in other parts of Europe, you can see clearly that even though they're following what you suggest, they've had major increase of terror activities, call it by Islamic terrorists of various sorts, and it seems to be increasing in various ways in their countries. I could also say the same if we look at Indonesia, Pakistan, etc., in other places. So I wonder if we ought to examine the fact that there is, quote, a war. Yes, we can say that the Iraq War was poorly done, inappropriate, the wrong direction, etc., etc. But it seems fairly clear to me that just as there was a situation where there was, quote, a Cold War, there is a situation now where you have a worldwide connection of groups who have terrorist intentions, who are willing to bomb civilian targets and other targets, and are, integrated in various parts of civilian populations. So I'd like to hear how you deal with that.
Yeah, well, no, you're right. There's certainly a serious problem, a kind of, I would call it a movement, more than a war, of certain fundamentalists who are willing to use violence against Western targets, often against Muslim targets as well, to make a point. And we've seen it in Europe. We've seen it in many parts of the world. And one thing I would say is that one of the big differences, say, between the UK and the US is that is the difference in our Arab and Muslim population and their Arab and Muslim population, and that is that our Arab and Muslim population in the United States is extremely well integrated, extremely highly educated, much more highly educated than the average American, much more professional in terms of their employment and the like than the average American, and we have not surprisingly, I suppose, at this point, found not a single al-Qaeda cell in the United States, and very little support for al-Qaeda in the United States. By contrast, in the UK, they have the Arab and Muslim population. I mean, there certainly are some very wealthy members of that population, but by and large, it is an underclass. It is consists of people who are very poor, who are very marginalized, who are not particularly educated, and are much more likely, therefore, to be alienated and to take extreme measures. And so, England and many parts of Europe have a much more serious homegrown problem than we do, and that requires different kinds of responses and solutions. But I don't think calling it a war really is responsive to that. I mean, it's a problem that you need to deal with, but they're not going to declare war on their own people.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
satisfied with that.
All right. Let's go on here to our line number one. Then this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Well, first, I'd like to take exception with the last caller, including Iraq in this supposed alliance against the Western world. There's not the faintest shred of evidence that Iraq, and in particular Saddam Hussein, had any thing to do with al-Qaeda. In fact, he was essentially the mortal enemy of the leaders of al-Qaeda. Or they were his mortal enemies. I'm not sure which is a better way of putting that. Secondly, there's a considerable difference between our population of Islamic people and that of the British and French in particular, and the Spanish, I suppose. They come from a population which went through a long struggle against an oppressive, occupying colonial power, namely Britain and France in particular. And I think that makes them more vulnerable today. Would you care to comment?
Well, that may well be true. I've generally heard more emphasis on the from security people on the kind of socioeconomic position of many of the Arab Muslim populations in Europe, but the trappings and traces of colonialism may also play a role. There are a number of things that may play a role, but the bottom line is that we have a very different different situation here. And I think the sense in the White House after 9/11 was that there are al-Qaeda cells out there, and we have to find them. And we locked up, just to identify one particular response of the Bush administration. We locked up over by the government's own admission over 5,000 foreign nationals in the United States in preventive detention measures, usually using immigration powers, designed to identify terrorists and deter terrorist activity. And of those 5,000 foreign nationals locked up, virtually all of them Arab Muslim, not one today stands convicted of a single terrorist offense. And virtually all of them were cleared of any involvement of terrorism, but not before they sat in jail for very long periods of time. So we sort of assumed we had a problem that we may not have had at all, and we acted on that assumption by preventively detaining thousands of people who had no connection to terrorism whatsoever simply because they were Arab, Muslim, and foreign national.
We just we have a couple of minutes left, and as you as we have discussed here, you have right from the beginning here of our conversation, the beginning of the book, been critical of the administration and its approach to dealing with terror, the thing that they call the preventive paradigm or paradigm of prevention, the term that apparently was coined by John Ashcroft, who was Attorney General. And this is, as you have explained, essentially in rather than going after people or states or organizations for what they've done, you go after them for what you think they might do. Now, you deal with this and deal with the implications throughout the book. There is a final section here, and in the last couple of minutes we have, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about what you think, you and your co-author think, would be a better approach.
Right. Well, thank you. Our book is sort of set, is in three sections. The first is how this preventive paradigm has made us less free by compromising our basic principles. The second is how it's made us less safe, going through the data on sort of what it's actually accomplished and what it hasn't accomplished. And the third is an alternative preventive strategy. We're not against prevention. You know, both I and my co-author brush our teeth on a regular basis. We believe in preventive medicine. What we don't believe in is random root canals. And I think the preventive paradigm is more in line with the random root canals. And so there are many, many preventive measures that we propose in Part 3 of the book that would be largely non-controversial, that don't involve the kind of using coercion against people who we guess might do wrong, but instead involve hardening targets, better intelligence gathering, better foreign policy initiatives so that we don't incite the kind of alienation and resentment that so many of our measures have taken. Treating the Muslim, supporting the moderate Muslim population instead of treating them as suspects until we convince ourselves that they're innocent. Better screening of cargo on passenger planes, of containers coming into shipping ports. These things cost money, but they cost a fraction of what we spend, you know, every month in Iraq, and would have a real a payoff in terms of making it harder for terrorists to attack us without entailing this sort of blowback effect that the more controversial measures have entailed. And we point to things, you know, much of this is not, you know, we're not the first people who've proposed this, and we point to things like the 9/11 Commission, which came up with 42 recommendations for how we could keep America safer after talking to all the country's top security experts. And you don't see their, rendering people to other countries to be tortured, using waterboarding on suspects, locking people up forever without hearings, disappearing people into secret CIA black sites, warrantless wiretapping. You see these much more sensible measures proposed, some of which I just laid out. And what's especially troubling is that a couple of years after it put out its report, the 9/11 Commission did a report card on how the Bush administration had been doing in terms of implementing these sensible preventive measures. And it's like no report card that you'd ever want to see your child come home with. It had something like 5 Fs, 8 Ds, 11 Cs, and 1 A-. So while the Bush administration has been talking tough and acting tough and engaging in these dramatic, showy kinds of measures that have largely backfired, it has been disregarding the much more sensible measures that might actually make us safer and make it more difficult for terrorists to attack us in the future.
Well, just very quick, and next year we're going to have a new president. We don't know whether that's going to be a Democrat or a Republican, but I think you, in the spirit of bipartisanship, you note in the conclusion that past administrations of both parties have made similar mistakes and that we're going to have problems here that will long outlast the Bush administration. So what do you think about the potential for things being different, no matter who the next president is?
Well, that's exactly right. We don't want this book to be an attack only on the Bush administration. It certainly is an attack on the strategy adopted by the Bush administration. But as we point out, you know, the previous proponent of a preventive paradigm was a Democrat, FDR, during World War II, and that led to the internment of 120,000 Americans and Japanese citizens simply because of their ethnicity in the name of prevention. So the preventive approach is something that I think is going to be a very powerful appeal to whoever the president is, whether he or she is Democrat or Republican, and we are going to continue to see these kinds of challenges no matter what party is in office. I've done work on terrorism and civil liberties for 20 years from President Reagan through the first President Bush through President Clinton and this President Bush. And President Clinton wasn't particularly sensitive to civil liberties issues when it came to the balance between terrorism and civil liberties either. He proposed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act after the Oklahoma City bombing, or he pushed it, and that's as bad as the Patriot Act. So I think the challenge is going to be a continuing one, and the reason we wrote this book was to try to reach out to people to say, look, there are reasons for of principle about our character, why we should be concerned about this kind of preventive paradigm approach. And there are also reasons to be concerned from our security, that this is just not the smart way to fight terror.
The book is Less Safe, Less Free, Where America is Losing the War on Terror, published by the New Press, co-authored by our guest David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University. Professor Cole, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.